Let's just move it on ever so slightly, because of course, well, one of the things that we're is dominating much of what we're talking about here on Five Live on Up All Night is the fallout, if you like, and the reaction from the EU referendum result from last week, which is not only sending shockwaves around Europe but also elsewhere. And you've got a British expat with you. I'd be keen to find out more.
Yes, I'm joined by Val Wright, who has lived in America for 12 years, and she's actually just written a book about business, and we'll talk to her about that after the news. But first of all, Val, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And as Duncan, you have just said, I think every expat, wherever they are in the world, is acutely aware of what's happening back at home of the moment. And here in California, I have experienced a vast array of emotions from people from despair to anger to obviously concern about the exchange rate, the pound-dollar exchange rate, which, if you're an expat in America, isn't good for you at the moment, to just pure amazement as to how events have unfolded. Val, what do you think, and what are your business clients here saying to you about it?
I think the biggest point is the amount of confusion that there is right now and that there was right up to decision day. I was in England a couple of weeks ago, right before and then during the big vote. And the biggest surprise to me was just how confusing all the messages were.
And so now that you've got back here, you clearly travelled during that crucial time, woke up in California and heard the news. How is it potentially going to change your life?
In terms of how much it'll change my life, I work with global companies, and so there are many global leaders that I help support. And one of the things that I'm helping them with, first of all, is how they are preparing for what might be, because there's so much unknown right now. And one of the thing that I observed when I was in England was what I call the magnifying glass and the megaphone effect, which is that unlike any other decision that's ever been made before, there was such a magnifying glass being put on every comment, whether you're a political leader, a business leader, or, you know, my friends and relatives, that there's a magnifying glass on what you say on social media. And then there's the megaphone effect, which is no matter what you say, it gets blasted everywhere. And in the past, it's been really private. And this is the first time such an important decision has had those two effects. And that makes a big difference, whether you're a politician, a business leader, or your friends and family in England or in America.
Okay, Peter and Val, well, we'll pick up on that in a few moments' time and just polish it off before we start looking at getting innovated on Five Live as we head up all night. It is the West Coast hour. It's just turned 2:30. Let's get the latest news headlines. Here's Nick Hatfield.
On DAB Digital Radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio Five Live. Up all night.
Good to have you along. I'm Duncan Barks, and you find us slap bang in the middle of our West Coast hour. Let's go back to Los Angeles. I'll chat with Peter Bowes and Val Wright. Val, I just wanted to really just finish off something you started before the news headlines when we were talking about the expat reaction to the EU referendum result. And you mentioned something quite interesting about social media. Do you think now in the 21st century, collectively, us as a society, perhaps a Western society, I don't know, we share too much online?
I think people don't think before they share, and more people need to think before they share or keep their social media mouth shut.
What's your thought, Peter?
I tend to agree with that. I think we live in a world where people have actually forgotten what it means to publish something through the internet. And perhaps it's because people who are doing that are not professional publishers. But if you wind the clock back 10 or 15 or 20 years, when those of us who are privileged to be in a position to broadcast or to publish through a magazine or a newspaper, you would think twice and three times and have a sub-editor look at what you write. People are doing that in an amateurish way now, and they are the ones that suffer. So I would agree with you, Val.
Okay, let's turn our attention to your book, Val. And what I'm going to do, if it's all right with you, is just solicit texts and tweets from Five Live listeners who are also up all night regarding perhaps some questions that maybe you could help them with off the back of your book, which is called Thoughtfully Ruthless. I mean, how would you describe this book in a sentence?
It's a way that you can magically create more time, boost your energy, and become more successful.
Right. And you're aiming this at business people. I've read the book, yep. And honestly, I'll say that this is applicable to anyone. There's some advice in here. You know, we're talking about how to manage your email, how to get your message across, and how to be... This is what I want to examine with you, how to be thoughtful about being ruthless, but perhaps not being nasty about being ruthless, because ruthless implies you're the guy or the lady in the office who people don't necessarily want to like.
Exactly. And that's some of the stereotypical views of leadership. You either have to be ruthless, mean and nasty, or you have to be lovable and likable. And that's why the play on words of being thoughtful about when you are ruthless, in terms of when do you spend your time on the right things? How are you selfish about your own energy? And how are you really intentional about the resources around you?
And where did you learn this? I mean, you've worked with some of the biggest, certainly tech companies, Silicon Valley style companies around these days. You've worked with Amazon, you've worked with Microsoft. Is that where you learned these lessons?
Yeah, I've been doing this for 25 years. Initially in England as part of House of Fraser, I worked for Land Rover and Marconi and then Microsoft. And I paid attention to those leaders who were mediocre, those leaders who were just about surviving, and then those leaders who really set themselves apart.
Let's just mention the text and the way of tweeting us. And you've got a question to Val regarding the content of a book, maybe about time management, coping in this electronic world that we live in. You can text us, ironically. 85058 is the text number. Any questions to Val, of course, you can tweet at BBC5Live. I'm very interested in this idea of time management, Val. Do you think everyone's got it within them to actually get a grip on juggling the various priorities in their lives?
Well, there are a million books available on time management in Amazon. And so clearly something's not working with those books or that advice. And that's why I don't just focus on the time management piece. You really have to focus on your energy and the resources around you as well. You know, everybody, you see people getting on a plane, they're all scrambling for the plugs to charge up the batteries. Everyone carries USB chargers around to make sure your mobile devices are, you know, they don't drop to that, you know, the 20% red danger zone. But think about your own energy and where is your current level? Are you at 100% fully charged and at capacity? No, most people tell people that they're exhausted and overwhelmed and too busy. And so you have to focus on your energy as well as the time as well.
So what do you do about that?
First of all, you have to figure out what's zapping your energy and get it out of your life. And then you have to figure out what it is that boosts your energy and be really selfish and prioritize that.
So when you get on a plane, rather than charging your phone, you should just close your eyes?
Absolutely. I mean, one of my chapters in my book is actually called Shush and Take Time to Be Silent, because with all these tweets and Facebook and all of this social media, it's like the proverbial knock on the door every 30 seconds.
It is becoming, isn't it, very trendy to talk about sleep these days. I mean, Arianna Huffington from the Huffington Post has written a book all about sleep and the importance of sleep and how it's virtually changed her life to pay more attention to getting those 8 hours at night. It seems oftentimes, you'll talk to people often in high-powered professional jobs, they will boast about how little sleep they've had.
Yes, exhaustion is not a badge of honour to be proud of. And Margaret Thatcher was the anomaly. She could, you know, take her job and run the country on 4 hours sleep. But sleep has been proven to be, it's more dangerous or as dangerous to drive while sleep deprived as it is to drive under the influence of alcohol. The same level of deterioration of your focus is whether you're sleep deprived or under the influence of alcohol. So think about that effect that has on your productivity.
Of course, not so easy. And Duncan, you might have a view of this. If you're working through the night,
well, you know,
sleeping through the day isn't so easy.
You know as well as I do, Peter, if you work shifts in whatever capacity and whatever you do for a living, you do become obsessed with sleep or indeed the lack of sleep. But Val, I'm wondering here, I mean, I'm going to ask you quite an open question. How do we do it? Because I understand the social media stuff, that with a bit of willpower, perhaps we can delete the Facebook or Twitter app from the smartphone or whatever. But if you do a kind of job that involves people asking you questions or you being in contact, maybe 24/7, and you've got the emails coming in, you've got the texts coming in, the idea of switching off completely for some people is quite a luxury. So how do you do it? What's the magic?
the magic is finding what works for you. So there is no one magic pill that will apply to every industry, every job, every person. Some people can survive on power naps. Some people need 8 hours solid. There's no one prescription. The important thing is that you play around with your own productivity levels and figure out what works for you, what's realistic. The biggest first step people can take is learning to say no more often. And that many times a lot of the exhaustion or overwhelm or over busy or over schedule is because people say yes when they should be saying no.
That's fascinating to me because I'm sure, Duncan, you're the same and you must be in your position as well. People will often say, oh, let's just meet for a couple of hours. Yes. Let's just do lunch. Let's just have a coffee. Oh, I'm in town. Can we just see each other? And you say, oh, yeah, of course we can. But when you really just want to get on with your day, but you don't want to be rude because you actually like them, yes. They're great people,
yes.
But you really honestly don't have those 2 hours. So how do you say no to them?
Well, this is the ruthless part of being thoughtful. And it was funny, I was talking to a bunch of Google executives at their headquarters last month. And I said to them, you know, you've got all this technology around you, you're growing so fast. What's the biggest barrier that's stopping you being more successful? And they said exactly the same thing. They said, we say yes too much, Val. We keep saying yes to all of these people who want our advice or want mentoring or want our help. And I said to them, well, there's a chapter in my book called The Power of No. And then I honestly lost the audience for 10 minutes because 20 people in the room turned to page 64 and they started reading saying, there's words here we can use that will help us say no. And it's the actual phrases. And there's a difference between saying no, never, or no, not right now, or no, not me. And so there are phrases there that literally for people who have difficulty saying no, you can pick them off the phrase straight off the book and put it in an email or say it on the phone. And sometimes you just need a script until it comes more naturally.
When you talk to executives, Val, about how to adopt a ruthless attitude to succeed, and you work with some very successful people, are they, I mean, you gave a sense there when they were turning to the pages in the book and looking at certain words, going, oh, we can use this word. Are you sometimes surprised when you kind of realise the situation they found themselves in?
I'm not, because I know what it's like. You know, I've managed large teams myself. Yeah. And so I know what it's like. It's so easy to get distracted. It's so easy to focus on the short term when you should be focusing on the long term. And so what I find when I work with executives is sometimes there's really quick, fast solutions that help them. And a key for me is never being surprised, because part of me helping them is me helping them see there are some simple things that they can immediately put in effect. And, you know, I met one leader when I was in the UK and I'd never met her before and she'd read my book. And she walked up to me, shook my hands and went, 20 hours, Val. And I said, what? She says, 20 hours. And I said, hello, nice to meet you. I'm Val. And she said, 20 hours. You have saved me 20 hours every single week from employing some of the simple tactics in your book. And so when I hear that, that makes me just want to give my book out to everyone.
So that's half the working week.
Yeah.
Well, she was working at 80 hour week and had dialed it down to 60, but even so, that was 20 hours. I mean, that was so profound for her. So I'm not surprised, because I've seen so many leaders.
And what are the key things that these executives complain to you about? And I suspect one of them could be about, because I hear it all the time, is email. Uh-huh. Email overload. And you write in your book, and it's fascinating to me, this tactic of delete all, of perhaps going away on holiday. The thing that we all dread, of course, is coming back from holiday, if we haven't been tempted while we're on holiday to check our email in the first place, but to come back to a load of emails to deal with. You suggest deleting them all and starting from scratch.
Yes, but you have to do a couple of things beforehand before you just kind of burn your inbox.
I thought you might.
First of all, you set yourself up before you go on holiday. And this is why the ideally you have a team of people or people that you can delegate your work to while you're away. And so you set your auto office to say, you know, Fred and Jane are going to keep control of these things while I'm away. My inbox will be wiped on my return. If there's anything urgent, please send it to me. And so that's one of the ruthless ways that, you know, many leaders I work with get 800 emails a day. You'd spend 2 weeks catching back up.
But it's ruthless and slightly nerve-wracking as well, because what about that person who doesn't read your auto response and they've sent you actually something that's quite important that could be useful to you in 3 weeks' time, and you really don't want to miss that information, and if you don't delete your emails, it's going to be there. Is that risk worth taking?
That's part of the choice. Part of the choice. Or you can spend 3 days digging yourself out of email of all those CCs of rubbish that you shouldn't be copied in on.
Well, isn't that right? And it's really interesting to hear you say that because it resonates with me. I mean, about 4 or 5 years ago when I was doing a slightly different job, I went away for a week and I came back to about 550, 600 emails. And out of sheer frustration, I deleted them all. And what was interesting about it was partly an experiment. What happened is I received probably 2 or 3 days of coming back from holiday, about 7 calls from people. And they were the 7 people who they needed immediate attention, whereas everyone else, it was just a typical case of CC someone in, you know, let's do this. And I think we've reached this point now where people almost cover their own backs by CCing a lot of other people into emails. And what we end up seeing is our inbox is clogged up. That leads to a lot of stress. And we find ourselves having the kind of conversations we're having at the moment on 5 Live. I've done this deleting of the 500, 600 emails. And I was quite shocked, actually, with how little resistance there was.
Interesting. A couple of years ago, did an interesting experiment in a similar vein. And I actually wrote about this on the BBC website, and that is not to use my electronic devices over a weekend. And so not to check email, not to switch my phone on to social media, not to use actually my computer at all at home. Yeah. Just to see what would happen. And yes, I was available. If anyone wanted to get me, they could telephone me. They could probably text me, and I would probably notice that. But I made a determined effort to just ignore everything else. I missed nothing.
Did you find it easy?
It's difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult. It's almost like a coffee addiction, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I was going to ask. Addiction. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, you go, addiction. My phone is right in front of me. You pick it up constantly. Mm-hmm. You try to check it. And if you go a few hours or even a couple of days without it, I knew I was going to do this. So in that respect, I was prepared for it. Mm-hmm. But you're constantly thinking, what am I missing?
Exactly. And it's, you get the thumb twitch of like, you're either grabbing your phone or your thumb twitch is you need to check and refresh. And what you go into is this kind of vortex. It's this black hole of the point of no return that sucks you in. And before you know it, you've lost 15 minutes, 45 minutes or an hour. I mean, part of the work I do with executive teams is I get them to agree how the team is going to communicate and when. Now, many teams use new technology like Slack, or, you know, some people use Twitter a lot, or, you know, Facebook use their own internal communications tools. So the key is getting the executive team to agree what the rules are. And what, you know, one of my favorite executives I work with used to send an email out saying, please no more thank you emails. You know, I get 25 emails saying thank you, thanks, cheers a day.
And let's some just people send... don't know when to stop. You say thanks and they're like, you're welcome.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Well,
it's
it goes
like,
on.
Stop filling my inbox.
I'll tell you a bugbear of mine is emails, and they're sent with utter affection by work colleagues when they say there are biscuits in the kitchen. And you get about maybe a dozen of these throughout the course of a day, and you go, I like the idea, and you're very kind that you purchased some biscuits, but can't you just tell people as opposed to clogging up my inbox?
Yeah, and especially when the kitchen is 3,000 miles away, yeah. It doesn't even apply to you anyway.
I'm interested in this idea, Val, because there's a lot of onus on the individual here, if you like, the employee. Could employers perhaps try and create an easier environment for people?
Absolutely, and that's a lot of the work that I do with executives, divisional heads or executive teams themselves, in terms of really identifying where are the time sucks and energy sucks that are happening in organisations, and what can be done to remove a lot of those. And the book covers things not just like email, but calendars and, you know, how meetings are scheduled. You know, I famously spoke to somebody who was in Microsoft, who was the design director of a game studio I worked at. And he said to me, he said, Val, why does every decision take 60 minutes? And I said, what do you mean? And he'd just been taken over by Microsoft. And he said, every meeting is 60 minutes. It's never 45 or 22. And so the time available is, the work available just expands to the meeting time. Every decision takes 60 minutes.
Do you need to put a time on a meeting, or couldn't it just be until we've made the decision, or would then that actually extend the time, perhaps?
That would be great. I recommend 15-minute meetings, 30-minute meetings. And one of the things I talk about is that you can reduce your meeting time by 75%, because half of all meetings are not needed at all. And of those that are needed, you only need half of the amount of people there.
That is so true, actually. I think, Peter, you and I can both relate to that remark. Oh, yes. where a lot of meetings that you turn up to and you think, well, you leave 1 hour later and you're absolutely right, 60 minutes, that's how they block it out on the calendar, and you walk away and you think, really did not need to be there.
Yes. Mm. So advice for your listeners is, if you control a meeting, you're in control and you can deal with it. Sometimes you're not in control of the meeting, but you can easily say, oh, I have a conflict, I need to leave after 30, or I need to leave after 45. And automatically you've given yourself a gift of 15 minutes or 30 minutes.
A lot of this is about self-discipline, isn't it? And getting in your own mind straight how you are going to behave and how you're going to behave towards other people, and applying that discipline initially to yourself and sticking to your own rules.
Absolutely, and it's one of the things I talk about to a lot of the people who I decide to give executive advice to, is I say to them, you may be surprised, but the biggest barrier to your own success is you.
Mm. You, I understand, Val, wrote this book, and it's quite a hefty tome here, in what, 4 months?
4 months.
You needed quite a lot of discipline, I imagine, to do that.
Absolutely. But also, when you're passionate about something, as I very much am, and I know what my perfectly productive places are, I won't say it was easy, but it came very naturally and I was energised by it.
One thing you did, I think you use a computer that isn't connected to the internet.
Absolutely, yes. Oh. I learned this through I was watching a TV show.
I mean, it's totally incapable of connecting to
the internet. Exactly.
It's not just switched off, it's incapable.
Yeah, it's called an air-gapped PC, one that has never been connected to the internet. And so I got a spare Mac. And all I had on it was Word documents with all my chapters. And I'd take it to my favourite place, which is Huntington Library. And I would sit there and type till the battery ran out. Then I'd get my notepad and I'd scribble. And I'd do that in chunks and I'd phase out how many words I was going to do. So I'd hit my deadline.
It's very interesting to hear how you've done this personally, and you know, you're leading by example. I mean, let's just revisit something that we talked about 30 minutes ago. In a climate that we are increasingly operating in, where you know, in our pockets, in my pocket right here, I've got a smartphone that connects me to the rest of the world. It's got social media apps on there. It's got email, etc., etc. Are we really able in the future to control this? I mean, being ruthless is a lovely idea, but will the culture allow us?
Yes, if you take control. And Peter and I were talking in our last conversation that there are some people in some jobs that can't completely disconnect forever, but I bet you can for 10 minutes. I bet you can for, you know, an hour on a Friday. And it's finding and carving out that time. And the other thing is, you know, the news stories that we had earlier this hour are about life and death.
Yeah.
This is not about life and death. There's no life and death in my book. And yet people sometimes in leadership roles or go about their daily life like it's life and death, and it's not. It's just making some tough decisions that are actually going to create more time and make you more successful.
Do you think there's going to become a sort of a tipping point, and especially as it applies to all of this stuff we're talking about, telephones and social media and websites and computers that are constantly connected to the rest of the world, is there going to become a tipping point in people's attitudes? Because I think as people, we have changed. We mentioned earlier this kind of addiction that we have. It can't keep going on like this, can it?
I agree. I think there's going to be a big shift towards back to the real handshake and back to face-to-face conversations. And I see it in executive circles. You know, when I speak at conferences, people still want to meet face-to-face. Executives still want to have a real handshake. People still want to connect in person because via the, you know, 140 characters on Twitter doesn't quite do it for people. And I think there's going to be a big shift.
It is interesting to hear you say that, and perhaps we should have introduced this point earlier in the hour with only a few minutes left, but I do wonder whether or not we're going to see, unless we get this almost mini-revolution of which you talk about, which I think many people listening will agree is needed, whether or not people are going to lose those very basic skills of one-on-one, face-to-face, verbal communication, because at the moment they are utterly used to sending emails or communicating via social media.
Absolutely, I agree.
And it's a generational thing as well, of course, isn't it? That there's a certain generation now that hasn't behaved in this way, that they're not so used to the face-to-face encounters. People date online.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an extension of that into the business world as well, that people are not growing up with the ways that certainly you and I grew up with.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, I firmly believe that people should really look at how they bring the voice of youth into their business, because paying attention to what teenagers and pre-teenagers are doing and how you build that into your business as you're developing products and services, and paying attention to that is really important, because that's what's going to really help understand how you can create more innovation.
But
in
I think
the company.
From what you're saying, the message is it's a mixture of both, isn't it? It's a mixture of what young people are doing and growing up with, and what an older generation did as well, and perhaps some of the more, to use the phrase, old-fashioned ways of of doing things that weren't necessarily all bad.
Absolutely, and putting controls around, you know, I've got three young children, so, you know, putting controls around how much technology they do have access to, so they can still run about and kick a football and swim and go spend their summer holidays having fun rather than attached to technology, which, you know, a lot of their parents are very attached to technology. And so who are they learning their lessons from? And, you know, how do you help kids become really ruthless and thoughtful with how they're spending their time as well?
Fowler, a final quick question. A point that you would make to anyone listening to Five Live at the moment who's been inspired by what you've had to say, what one thing that they can take away from our chat and just kind of hold on to if they think that technology is taking over their lives?
Reduce the time that you spend on technology by 15 minutes a day.
Wise words. Peter, I enjoyed that. Val, thank you very much indeed. And Peter, very quickly, you've read the book. Are you putting some of these techniques into practice?
Yes, I am trying to. And I think all this stuff about technology and just having the courage to just put it to one side, as you say, for 15 minutes, you can reap the rewards.
I promise I won't send you a thank you email. I'll just say thank you for your time over the last 60 minutes.
I'll just
minutes.
Say you're welcome.
Probably. Bless you. Peter Bold and Val Wright. It's the West Coast Hour on Up All Night on 5 Live.